welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like you, has just flipped the calendar to the month of May. May and May Day. Ever wondered about the history of that day? I have, so I set about doing what I love most, research. First, of course, May Day is related to the Celtic festival of Beltane and the Germanic festival of Walpurgis Night. The earliest May Day holiday celebrated the festival of Flora, the Roman goddess of flowers. Now, here's something I never knew. In pre-Christian European cultures, May 1st was designated as the first day of summer. Hence, June 21st, the summer solstice, was called midsummer. A more secular version of May Day continues to be observed in Europe and America, often celebrated with its tradition of the Maypole dance and the crowning of the Queen of the May. In Roman Catholic tradition, May is observed as Mary's month, and the Virgin's head is often adorned with flowers in a May crowning. Now, more recently, and the inspiration for our show today, the May Day call sign originated in 1923 by Frederick Stanley Mockford, a senior radio officer at the Croydon Airport in London. Mockford had been asked to find a word to indicate distress, one that would be easily understood by all pilots and ground staff in an emergency. Since much of the traffic of the time was between Croydon and Le Bourget Airport in Paris, he proposed the word Mayday from the French Maider. Venez, Maider means come help me. Well, that sheds some light on this subject. So today we'll look at literary Maydays, guys and damsels in distress, characters who get themselves into some very treacherous situations. Luckily for those of us who love the genre. And today, the Book Report will speak with a legendary author of 32 best-selling thrillers. Great reading and listening ahead as we turn to page one of the Book Report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. In Chris Ewan's The Good Thief's Guide to Paris, book two in the popular series, Charlie Howard, globe-trotting mystery writer, professional thief, and poor decision-maker, is in Paris. Flush with the success of his latest book, Charlie agrees to show a complete novice how to break into an apartment in the Marais. Fast forward 24 hours, and Charlie's hired to steal an ordinary-looking oil painting from the exact address. Mere coincidence? Charlie figures there's no harm in finding out until a dead body turns up in his living room and he's evading the law for his part in the heist. Nobody ever said a life of suspense was easy, even for Charlie, the most disarmingly charming burglar since Cary Grant. Simon Vance narrates.
The night concierge reappeared just as we entered. He frowned, his hand suspended above a fire extinguisher that was mounted on the wall behind his desk. "Bonsoir, monsieur," I said breezily, treating him to a casual wave and a friendly bow, meanwhile taking Bruno by the arm and guiding him across the foyer. Bruno's feet seemed to catch in one another. I glanced sideways at the concierge. He still hadn't moved. "Quatrième étage," I managed, jabbing my finger towards the ceiling. Finally the concierge shrugged and murmured something under his breath as though he couldn't care less where we were heading. "Bonsoir," I added pointlessly, and watched as he turned his back on us to heave the extinguisher from the wall and return to the alley. At the far side of the foyer, Bruno pressed the call button for the elevator. I heard an antique-sounding chime and the whirring of hidden cogs and cables, followed by the muted ringing of the elevator bell as the single carriage descended towards us. From outside came the whoosh and squirt of extinguisher foam. There was a pause, followed by a second, and then a third blast of the extinguisher, accompanied by one of the few French words I could recall from my school exchange. The foyer itself was eerily quiet and the lighting subdued as if to prepare us for sleep. The decor was stylish, though minimalist. Flecked marble tiles covered the floor beneath our feet, and the off-white walls were hung with a handful of bold, modern canvases. Sure, the concierge might not have said anything, but he worked in a quality building, and it was reasonable to assume he was suspicious about our arrival coinciding with the fire.
"This is taking too long," I whispered to Bruno. "There are stairs." "No, it'd look odd. I just wish the elevator would hurry up."
Bruno checked the dial above our heads.
"Two more floors." "Marvellous."
I contemplated my feet, noting that my shoes could do with a clean. It was a job I'd meant to tackle before showing up for my book reading. Mind you, my tardiness hadn't seemed to put anyone off. By the end of the evening, I'd sold more books than I'd anticipated, and that happy state of affairs had a lot to do with how much wine I'd drunk afterwards. And the wine had a lot to do with why I'd agreed to show Bruno how to set about breaking into an apartment building. I guess if I was the type of chap to keep my shoes clean, I probably wouldn't have got involved in such a harebrained scheme in the first place. It's amazing, really, how much trouble a good shoe shine can save. If I'd had the time, I suppose I could have turned my mind to what other chores I might have better occupied myself with, but right then the elevator bell chimed twice more and the burnished metal doors jerked apart. We stepped inside the cramped elevator interior, the carriage bouncing with our weight, and turned around just as the concierge returned to his position behind the reception desk.
That was The Good Thief's Guide to Paris by Chris Ewan. Mary Higgins Clark's books are worldwide bestsellers. In the U.S. alone, she sold over 80 million copies. The author of 32 suspense novels, two of her novels have been made into feature films. Other works and short stories have been turned into made-for-TV movies. She's also co-authored five suspense novels with her daughter, Carol Higgins Clark. Mary was born and raised in the Bronx. After high school and after the early death of her father, Mary went to secretarial school so she could help with family finances. She worked at an ad agency for 3 years, then flew off as a stewardess on international flights for Pan Am. During her year with the airline, she definitely met adventure as she was caught in a revolution in Syria and was on the last flight into Czechoslovakia before the Iron Curtain went down. She left the skies to marry Warren Clark and began writing short stories. Her first story sold to Extension Magazine in 1956 for $100. Left a young widow in 1964, Mary worked writing radio scripts and tried her hands at writing books. Every morning, she got up at 5 and wrote until 7 a.m., when she had to get her five children ready for school. Her first suspense novel, Where Are the Children?, was published in 1975, and the rest is publishing history. Welcome, Mary. It's such an honor to have you as our guest on the Book Report.
Oh, Elaine, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Introduce us to the characters in Daddy's Gone A-Hunting.
Oh, well, thank you. They're my favorite people at this point. Imagine. There are two sisters, Hannah, who is 28, and she's a rising young dress designer, and her 30-year-old sister is Kate, and Kate is a CPA, and Kate is the motivating person in this book because they own a family complex of reproducing fine antique furniture, but the business is going down the tube. And Kate has been saying to their father, who is a spendthrift, we have got to sell the business, and we have got to close the business and sell the property because we're losing money. And she says, I'd like to throw a match into the whole place with the way it's costing us money. And then, unfortunately, she is there at 4:30 in the morning with a disgruntled workman who works for them, and the place goes up in flames. and Kate is accused of setting a crime, and the fire not only destroys the complex, but causes a sinkhole, and in the sinkhole is the skeleton of a young actress who has been missing for 28 years. So that's kind of the kickoff of the story.
Oh, many of your books have been based on actual crimes. Is that the case with Daddy's Gone A-Hunting?
Not so much as incidents. And, of course, arson is a frequent crime, particularly when the business isn't doing well. And the other thing is, there is nothing worse than having someone in the family missing and you don't know what happened. They just didn't get home that night. And the family never has peace. Ted Bundy, he was a serial killer. And even when he was being executed, he was spitting out names of the girls whom he had killed in those months that he was going from city to city killing girls. And one night, he gave a name, and that night, for the first time, the mother and father of the girl turned out the light on the porch. Mm. I use that in this book because there is something about not knowing what happened to someone that 28 years later to find the truth is so necessary.
Right. Now, twin brothers are central to this story. Have there been actual crimes with twins at the core?
Oh, yes, there have. In fact, there were twins in New York who were doctors, and one would start the operation and the other would finish it. And even the nurses were not sure which one was which. If the doctor just stepped away for a minute, they never realized his brother was finishing it. Hmm. So, yes, that has happened. And my editor was fascinated by it. And several times I have used twins in a story. The last one, it was three-year-old twins.
Hmm. Now, I know that your editor is Michael Korda. How did you meet?
Well, my first book was bought by Simon & Schuster, my first suspense book, Where Are the Children? And the editor who bought it left right after she bought it and went to work for another publishing house. And Michael took over as my editor. And he and I have been together for 40 solid years, can you imagine?
Wow.
I said we've grown old together, although I have a few years on Michael.
Can you tell aspiring writers what an editor actually brings to a work?
Oh, so much. An editor is the captain of the ship, and the writer is writing the book, but the captain is saying, be careful about this. Don't use that in a book. He will say, for example, in the book with the three-year-old twins, he said, Mary, you've got to make your audience realize how alike these twins are, that psychologically as well as physically, they look alike. He said, I want you to have a character in that book, a doctor who specializes in twins, and she is the one who is saying to the police when they get one of them back, she is in communication with her sister. She is talking to her sister. So that's what an editor does. Or he'll say, don't do that. Or when I say, oh, Michael, I'm not sure if this chapter works, I send him 25 or 30 pages. And he says, this chapter is fine. What's the problem? So he's the captain of the ship.
Oh. Now, I know your daughter, Carol, is an author, and I actually interviewed her in December of 2010 after she released her novel, Wrecked. What is it like to collaborate with her, and how do you split up the duties?
We do it together. We write every single word together.
Hmm.
We write every single word together, and I say, suppose she says this. Carol might say, no, I don't like that. But... or I will reverse the process and when she has an idea and I say, I don't think it works. Or sometimes we both come out with the same idea. When we decided that Reagan was going to get a boyfriend, what's his last name? And we both screamed it at the same time. Riley, the very same name as her character, Reagan Riley. And we just high-fived each other because here is Jack Riley calling on Reagan Riley.
I saw an interview that you gave, and you said, for me, writing is a need. It's the degree of yearning that separates the real writer from the would-be's. I love that. Tell us more.
Well, you see, there are many people who literally have the gift of writing. They do have the gift. And they say, I'm going to write a book as soon as. And I say, stop right there. It's never going to happen. As soon as the children grow up, as soon as I quit my job, as soon as the dog dies, I'll have time to do it. There'll be another great set of reasons why it's not going to work. If you have that desire, then you should start now. And I always say, go to a local college, a community college, and take a course in writing, because then you get an assignment, and it gets you going. You know, as opposed to just sitting down and saying, gee, what'll I write? But there are people who, with the talent and with the desire, but those of us who become professional, we have a need to write. We will write even when we're rejected, day in and day out. I had 40 short stories in the mail before I sold that first one. And it was out so many times in 6 years. And then they said, have you got another one? Yeah, boy, howdy, do I have. And when my first book, the book about George Washington, went nowhere, it did become a bestseller later on. But when it went nowhere, I started another book. You know, people say I wrote a book and it didn't sell, so I guess I'm not a good writer. I guess I'll never make it. Even the book, you know, the book that has taken the world by storm, or the trilogy of the 50 Shades of Grey, that was a self-published book that was picked up. Hmm. And I advise people to self-publish their books. It doesn't cost much money. Most of them won't be picked up. But you never know. And the other part of it is, if someone older writes a book about the way we were, the family, my grandchildren love my memoir because it tells about my growing up. It tells about their great-grandparents.
What are you working on now? What's next?
The next one is going to have a redo of a crime. The people who are involved in the crime, 20 years later, are going on a television program to talk about it and to go over it. And one of them is killed.
Well, I have to tell you that I really loved the book, Daddy's Got a Hunting. I read it almost in one sitting. It was that much of a page turner. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
A great pleasure, Elaine. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Daddy's Got a Hunting, narrated by Jan Maxwell.
Sometimes Kate dreamed about that night, even though it wasn't a dream. It had really happened. She was 3 years old and had been curled up on the bed, watching Mommy getting dressed. Mommy looked like a princess. She was wearing a beautiful red evening gown and the red satin high heels that Kate loved to try on. Then Daddy came into the bedroom, and he picked Kate up and danced her and Mommy onto the balcony, even though it was beginning to snow. I begged him to sing my song, and he did, Kate remembered. Bye, baby bunting. Daddy's gone a-hunting. A rosy wisp of cloud to win, to wrap his baby bunting in. The next night, Mommy died in the accident, and Daddy never sang that song to her again. Thursday, November 14th. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Gus Schmidt dressed silently in the bedroom of his modest home on Long Island, hoping not to disturb his wife of 55 years. He was not successful. Lottie Schmidt's hand shot out to fumble for the lamp on the night table. Blinking to clear eyes that were heavy with sleep, She noticed that Gus was wearing a heavy jacket and demanded to know where he was going.
Lottie, I'm just going over to the plant. Something came up.
Is that why Kate called you yesterday?
Kate was the daughter of Douglas Connolly, the owner of Connolly Fine Antique Reproductions, the furniture complex in nearby Long Island City, where Gus had worked until his retirement 5 years earlier. Lottie, a slight 75-year-old with thinning white hair, slipped on her glasses and glanced at the clock.
Gus, are you crazy? Do you know what time it is?
It's 4 o'clock and Kate asked me to meet her there at 4:30. She must have had her reasons and that's why I'm going.
Lottie could see that he was clearly upset. Lottie knew better than to ask the question that was on both their minds.
Gus, I've had a bad feeling lately. I know you don't want to hear me talk like this, but I sense something dark is going to happen. I don't want you to go.
In the shadowy 60-watt light of the night table lamp, they glared at each other. Even as Gus spoke, he knew deep down he was frightened. Lottie's claim to be psychic both irritated and scared him.
Lottie, go back to sleep, he said angrily. No matter what the problem is, I'll be back for breakfast.
Gus was not a demonstrative man, but some instinct made him walk over to the bed, lean down, kiss his wife's forehead, and run his hand over her hair.
Don't worry, he said firmly.
They were the last words she would ever hear him say. 2. Kate Connolly hoped that she would be able to hide the restless anxiety she felt about her pre-dawn appointment with Gus in the museum of the furniture complex. She had dinner with her father and his newest girlfriend in Zone, the fashionably new cafe in Manhattan's Lower East Side. Over cocktails, she made the usual small talk that rolled easily off her tongue when she chatted with his flavor of the moment. This one was Sandra Starling, a platinum blonde beauty in her mid-20s with wide-set hazel eyes, who earnestly explained that she had been a runner-up in a Miss Universe contest, but became vague as to exactly how far she had been from winning the crown. Her ambition, she confided, was to have a career in the movies and then dedicate herself to world peace.
This one is even dumber than most of the others, Kate thought sardonically.
Doug, as she had been instructed to call her father, was his genial and charming self, although he seemed to be drinking more heavily than usual. Throughout the dinner, Kate realized that she was appraising her father as if she were a judge on America's Got Talent or Dancing with the Stars. He's a handsome man in his late 50s, she thought, a lookalike for legendary film star Gregory Peck. Then she reminded herself that most people her age wouldn't have any real appreciation of that comparison. Unless, like me, they're devotees of classic movies, she thought. Was she making a mistake to bring Gus in on this? She wondered.
Kate, I was telling Sandra that you're the brains of the family, her father said.
I hardly think of myself as that, Kate answered with a forced smile.
Don't be modest, Doug Connolly chided. Kate is a certified public accountant, Sandra. Works for Wayne and Crothers, one of the biggest accounting firms in the country. He laughed. Only problem is, she's always telling me how to run the family business.
That was Daddy's Gone A-Hunting by Mary Higgins Clark. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com.
Michael Palmer's Political Suicide is a gripping thriller at the crossroads of politics and medicine. Dr. Lou Welcome, through his work in the Physician's Wellness Office, has been tasked with supervising Dr. Gary McHugh, a former blackout drinker and bon vivant known around the Capitol as Society Doc. McHugh has been very cavalier about his recovery, barely attending AA. But Lou sees progress, and the two men are on the road to becoming friends. Then McHugh is found unconscious in a wrecked car after visiting his patient, Elias Colston, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. When McHugh awakens in the ER, he learns the congressman's wife has found her husband shot dead in their garage, and she'd informed the police she'd just broken off a long-standing affair with Dr. McHugh. Lou wants to believe McHugh's innocence, but when he uncovers motive, method, and opportunity, he's hard-pressed to do so. Then, a deadly high-level conspiracy begins to unravel, and Lou acquires information that makes him the next target. Robert Petkoff narrates.
Dr. Louis Francis Welcome could do a lot of things well, but doing nothing was not one of them. His desk at the Washington, D.C. Physician Wellness Office, one of four cubicle work areas jammed inside 850 square feet, had never been so uncluttered. On a typical mid-afternoon, the voicemail light on Lou's Nortel telephone would be blinking red, a harbinger that one or more of his doctor clients needed advice and support in their recovery from mental illness, behavioral problems, or drug and alcohol abuse. At the moment, that light was dark, as it had been for much of the past several days. Lou got paid to manage cases and monitor the progress of his assigned physicians, with the express goals of guiding them into recovery and eventually getting surrendered licenses reinstated. The holiday season inevitably brought an influx of new docs, often ordered to the PWO by the D.C. Board of Medicine. But not recently. He strongly suspected the lack of clients did not indicate a dwindling need for PWO services. On the contrary, as with the general population, the stress accompanying the last 6 weeks of the year unmasked plenty of physicians in trouble for a variety of reasons. So why in the hell, he mused, absently constructing a chain from the contents of his inlaid mother-of-pearl paperclip box, was he not getting any new cases? There was, he knew, only one logical explanation for the paucity of referrals. Dr. Walter Filstrip, the director of the program. Rhythmically compressing a rubber relaxation ball imprinted with Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, Lou sauntered over to the reception desk, where Babs Peterby seemed to be quite busy. "Hi there, Dr. Welcome," she said, her round, matronly face radiating a typical mix of caring and concern. "I didn't see you come in." "Ninja doctor," Lou said, striking a pose. "Any calls?" "A man who said he wanted to talk to you about the head of his department drinking too much. I referred him to Dr. Filstrip's voicemail."
"Did you get his name?"
Peterby forced a smile. "Not my job."
The woman's favorite phrase. Lou said the words in unison with her. The woman definitely knew how to make it through her day unscathed. "Not my job."
"BP, is Walter in?" Lou asked. "His door's been closed since I got here." "He's having a telephone meeting right now," Peterby said, cocking her head to the right, toward the only door in the suite except for the one to the small conference room across from her. The door was also the only one with a name placard, this one bronze and elegantly embossed with Filstrip's name and degree. "Is this a real meeting or a Filstrip meeting?" Again, Peterby strained to smile. "How's your daughter?" she asked.
"Emily's doing great, thank you," Lou said, shifting his 6-foot frame from one foot to the other and switching the Pfizer ball to his left hand. She's closing in on 14 going on 30, and is far more skilled than even our esteemed boss at skirting issues she doesn't want to deal with. So I'll ask again, is Walter really busy? This time, Peter B. glanced down at her phone bank and shook her head, as though she was no longer betraying whatever promise she had made to Filstrup. Looks like he's off now. When the Employee of the Year awards come up, BP, I'm nominating you. Such loyalty. You mean poverty? That too. His overall mood? I would say maybe cat too. The small staff at the PWO measured the volatile director's demeanor on the Saffir-Simpson scale used by meteorologists to rate the power of hurricanes. Cat-Dew isn't so bad, Lou said, mostly to himself. Blustery, but not life-threatening. It won't stay that way if you go barging in there, Dr. Welcome, Peter B. admonished. Lou blew her a kiss. Never fear, he said. I've got a Kevlar life preserver on under my shirt.
That was Political Suicide by Michael Palmer. Chosen as Amazon's Book of the Year in 2011, Into the Darkest Corner by Elizabeth Haynes is a gripping page-turner. Catherine has been enjoying the single life long enough to know a good catch when she sees one. Gorgeous, charismatic, spontaneous, her new guy Lee seems almost too perfect to be true. But there is a darker side to Lee. His erratic, controlling, and sometimes frightening behavior means that Catherine is becoming increasingly isolated. Driven into the darkest corner of the world and trusting no one, she plans a meticulous escape. 4 years later, struggling to overcome her demons, Catherine dares to believe she might be safe from harm. Then, one phone call changes everything. David Thorpe and Karen Cass narrate.
She had locked me in the house and hidden the key somewhere. She went mad at me. I'd been working on a particularly difficult job, and something inside me snapped. I hit her back. It was the first time I'd ever hit a woman. The last time. What date are you talking about exactly? It was in June. The 13th, I think. Would you take us through that day? I stayed the night before at Catherine's house. I was on duty that weekend, so I left for work before Catherine woke up. When I came back to her house that evening, she was at home and she had been drinking. She accused me of spending the day with another woman. The same thing I heard over and over again. I took it for a while, but after a couple of hours, I'd had enough. I went to walk away, but she had double-locked the front door. She was screaming and swearing at me over and over again, slapping me with her hands, scratching my face. I pushed her backwards, just enough to get her away. Then she just threw herself at me again and I hit her. How did you hit her, Mr. Brightman? Was it a punch? A slap? I hit her with a closed fist. I see. And what happened then? She didn't stop. She just yelled louder and came at me again, so I hit her again. I guess it was probably harder. She fell over backwards, and I went to see if she was all right, to help her up. I think I must have trodden on her hand. She screamed and yelled at me and threw something. It was the key to the front door. What did you do next? I took the key, unlocked the front door, and left. What time was that? It must have been about 7:15. And when you left her, what condition was she in? She was still shouting and screaming. Was she injured? Bleeding? I think she may have been bleeding. Could you elaborate, Mr. Brightman? She had some blood on her face. I don't know where it came from. It wasn't a lot of blood. And did you have any injuries yourself? I just had some scratches. Did you consider that she might have needed medical attention? No. Even though she was apparently bleeding and crying out? I don't recall that she was crying out. As I left the house, she was shouting and swearing at me. If she needed medical attention, I believe she could have got it herself without my help. I see. So, after you left the house at 7:15, did you see Miss Bailey again? No, I didn't see her again. Did you contact her by telephone? No. Mr. Brightman, I want you to think very carefully before answering my next question. How do you feel now with regard to the incidents of that day? I have deep regret for everything that happened. I loved Catherine. I'd asked her to marry me. I had no idea she was so emotionally disturbed, and I wish to God I hadn't retaliated. I wish I had just tried harder to calm her down. Thank you. No further questions, Your Honour. Cross-examination. Mr. Lewis.
Mr. Brightman, would you have described your relationship with Miss Bailey as a serious one?
Mr. Brightman. I thought it was, yes. Mr. Lewis.
Do you understand that it is part of your terms and conditions of employment that you will inform your employers of changes in your personal circumstances, including providing the details of your relationships?
Mr. Brightman.
Yes.
We've just heard Into the Darkest Corner by Elizabeth Haynes. Into the Woods is book one of Tanya French's popular Dublin Murder Squad series. As dusk falls on a small Dublin suburb in the summer of 1984, three children go missing. The police begin to search the nearby woods and find only one of the children. He is gripping a tree trunk in terror, wearing blood-filled sneakers and unable to recall a single detail. 20 years later, that boy, Rob Ryan, is a detective on the Dublin Murder Squad. His past is his secret. But when a 12-year-old girl is found murdered in the same woods, he and his partner find themselves investigating a case chillingly similar to his unsolved mystery. Now, with only snippets of long-buried memories to guide him, Ryan has a chance to uncover both the current mystery and that of his shadowy past. Steve Crossley narrates.
These three children own the summer. They know the wood as surely as they know the micro-landscapes of their own grazed knees. Put them down blindfolded in any dell or clearing, and they could find their way out without putting a foot wrong. This is their territory, and they rule it wild and lordly as young animals. They scramble through its trees and hide and seek in its hollows all the endless day long, and all night in their dreams. They're running into legend, into sleepover stories and nightmares parents never hear. Down the faint lost paths you would never find alone, skidding round the tumbled stone walls, they stream calls and shoelaces behind them like comet trails. And who is it waiting on the riverbank with his hands in the willow branches, whose laughter tumbles swaying from a branch high above? Whose is the face in the undergrowth, in the corner of your eye, built of light and leaf shadow, there and gone in a blink? These children will not be coming of age, this or any other summer. This August will not ask them to find hidden reserves of strength and courage as they confront the complexity of the adult world and come away sadder and wiser and bonded for life. This summer has other requirements for them. 1. What I warn you to remember is that I'm a detective. Our relationship with truth is fundamental but cracked, refracting confusingly like fragmented glass. It's the core of our careers, the end game of every move we make, and we pursue it with strategies painstakingly constructed of lies and concealment and every variation on deception. The truth is the most desirable woman in the world, and we are the most jealous lovers, reflexively denying anyone else the slightest glimpse of her. We betray her routinely, spending hours and days stupor deep in lies, and then turned back to her holding out the lover's ultimate Mobius strip. But I only did it because I love you so much. I have a pretty knack for imagery, especially the cheap facile kind. Don't let me fool you into seeing us as a bunch of parfy genteel knights galloping off in doublets after Lady Truth on her white palfrey. What we do is crude, crass, and nasty. A girl gives her boyfriend an alibi for the evening when we suspect him of robbing a North Side Centra and stabbing the clerk. But I flirt with her at first, telling her I can see why he would want to stay home when he's got her. She's peroxided and greasy, with the flat, stunted features of generations of malnutrition, and privately, I'm thinking that if I were her boyfriend, I would be relieved to trade her even for a hairy cellmate named Razor. Then I tell her we've found marked bills from the till in his classy white tracksuit bottoms, and he's claiming that she went out that evening and gave them to him when she got back. I do it so convincingly, with such delicate cross-hatching of discomfort and compassion at her man's betrayal, that finally her faith in 4 shared years disintegrates like a sandcastle.
That was Into the Woods by Tanya French. After a shootout claims the life of his partner in a condemned tenement on Pearl Street, Detective John Tallow unwittingly stumbles across an apartment stacked high with guns. When examined, each weapon leads to a different, previously unsolved murder. Someone has been killing people for 20 years or more and storing the weapons together. The mystery begins in Gun Machine by Warren Ellis. Confronted with the sudden emergence of hundreds of unsolved homicides, Tallow discovers he's walked into a deal with the devil, an unholy bargain that was made possible by the rise of some of Manhattan's most prominent captains of industry. Reg Cathay narrates.
John Tallow stood while the medic scraped up and lifted and bagged and took away his partner of 4 years. And then he sat on the stair silently, so that they had to lift Rosado's killer over him to get him down and out of the building. People said things to him. Gunfire in close quarters had temporarily dulled his hearing, and he wasn't that interested anyway. Someone told him that the lieutenant was driving out to tell Rosado's wife the bad news. She liked to do that, the lieutenant, to take that weight off her people. He'd known her to do it 3 or 4 times in the past few years. After a while, he became aware that someone was trying to get his attention, a uniformed police. Behind him, the crime scene unit techs were moving around like beetles. This one apartment, the uniform said. What? We checked all the apartments to make sure everyone was okay, but this apartment here, there's a shotgun hole in the wall and no one's answering the door. Did you check this one apartment? No. Wait, what? That hole's kind of low. I don't think it can have hit anyone. Well, maybe the occupant's out at work, though that'd make him kind of unique in this building so far. Tallow shrugged. Force the door, then. The door's tight. Can't imagine what kind of lock's behind it, but it don't want to give. Tallow got up. He knew buildings like these weren't Fort Knox, but if the uniform said the door wasn't giving, it was pointless to repeat the effort. The door wasn't the thing. The hole was. He got down on one knee by the hole. The internal walls in these places weren't worth the name. Plasterboard partitions for the most part. When this building was crammed with people way back when, it must have been like living in a hive. The hole was a foot across. Tallow peered through it. No light in there. Tallow shifted his position to let in ambient light from the hallway. The uniform watched him frown. Give me a flashlight, Tallow said. Tallow twisted it on and played it through the hole. Things glinted in the dark, as if he were shining the flashlight into the teeth of an animal deep in a cave. Get a ram, Tallow said. The uniform went downstairs while Tallow sat on the floor with his back to the wall, dismissing the CSU complaints with a finger. That'd come back to bite him later, he knew. CSUs love to complain, and if he didn't listen, they'd find someone who would. Then again, maybe he'd earned a pass today. Talos sat and thought about his partner for a while. Thought about never having met his wife. Having actively avoided it, if he were honest. Remembered feeling relieved that Jim and his wife had gotten married on vacation, so he couldn't and therefore didn't have to attend the ceremony. Talo had decided after the one time he'd had to crush a stranger with the news that her husband had died on duty with three big bullets in his gut, that he couldn't be married. He didn't want to stand at a wedding and think about being married. He didn't want to sit at Jim Rosado's table and think about being married. The uniform had found another uniform, and together they had unhappily carried the ram upstairs, blistered black paint over blue metal. Talo stayed on the floor and hitched his thumb at the door. The uniforms put the ram to the door. It bent and held. They looked at each other, swung back harder, and drove the ram in again. Wood splintered, but the door stood. Talo got up. Take out the wall. You sure? Yes, on me. Take it out. The ram crushed the wall in. A few dull thumps sounded from within. The CSUs cursed their mothers for the dust the strike kicked out. Three more short swings made a hole big enough for Talo to step through. Two more dull thumps. He twisted on the borrowed flashlight and passed it around slowly. The room was full of guns. Guns were mounted on all the walls. There were half a dozen guns at his feet. Turning around, flashlight at shoulder level, he saw that guns were mounted on the wall he had come in through. Some guns were mounted in rows, but the right-hand wall had them in complex swirls. Some were laid on the floor on the far side of the room, forming a shape he couldn't quite fathom.
We've just heard Gun Machine by Warren Ellis. After his arrest in December 2003, registered nurse Charlie Cullen was quickly dubbed the Angel of Death. But Cullen was no mercy killer, nor was he a simple monster. He was a favorite son, husband, beloved father, best friend, and celebrated caregiver. Implicated in the deaths of as many as 300 patients, he was also perhaps the most prolific serial killer in American history. Cullen's murderous career spanned 16 years and 9 hospitals across New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Now, in a riveting piece of investigative journalism, nearly 10 years in the writing, journalist Charles Graber presents the whole story for the first time. The Good Nurse, a true story of medicine, madness, and murder, weaves an urgent, terrifying tale of murder, friendship, and betrayal. Will Collier narrates.
Every case starts with a call. Dispatch sends a marked car, and the uniforms look over the bodies, sort accidents from suicides, and what they call natural deaths. When it's none of those, when they can't say for sure what the hell happened, they call homicide. Each body is a death, but not every death is a crime scene. Generally, the very young are accidents, the very old are natural deaths, and almost everyone else gets shot. At least, that was how it panned out in Newark. Suicides don't always look like suicides. For the bodies that come off one of the housing towers, the question becomes, did he jump, or was he pushed? Statistically, the depressed don't leap. They fall. You take out the tape and check the charts. If it's a shooting death and the gun's still there, that's a possible suicide, too. No matter how many bullet holes. Bodies on the corner are almost always murder. Bodies on the tracks are a mess. And bodies in the river are mysteries. You hear stories of cops poking floaters back out into the Passaic, toward another jurisdiction. The detective on call takes whatever comes during his 24-hour shift. He might get lucky and catch none. But one night, when he still worked Newark, Tim Braun caught 4. In those days, he seemed to attract bodies. If he was in the box, he got them. That's the way it works in most precincts. It's up to the detective to figure the priority of the cases. But every new murder shuffles the deck. The top case is the red ball. The one everyone wants off his desk. The one that needs to just go away. In Newark, if the news cameras were on the scene before Tim, it was definitely a red ball. If a child or some mayor's son was involved, red ball. But that could change. Red ball is a temporary designation, a hot hand that can go cold quick. And every new murder reshuffles it. Every new body changes the priorities. Each call resets the clock. The first bodies Tim Braun ever saw were when he was working as a security guard at St. Barnabas Medical Center, his hometown mega hospital in Livingston, New Jersey. Tim was still a teenager, vigorous and bulletproof, and the elderly bodies weren't real bodies to him. They were just anonymous husks, weight that Big Tim carried whenever a cute nurse asked. The first body that mattered came later. Tim was a new cop on patrol, a uniform responding to a call. A fisherman led him through the reeds near the river. The guy in the mud was dressed in ordinary clothes. He had pockets and shoes. He was normal, but for the red line across his neck, and the spine flashing white like a broken smile. He was a victim, what they called a vic. It can sound crass to someone outside law enforcement, but the language of the death business is intentionally impersonal. See too much, feel too personal a connection, and the job becomes impossible. But Tim hadn't learned that yet. That fall, Tim took the tests to transfer to Newark, heading toward a career in homicide. Newark, in the 1990s, was the center of the murder universe, the most dangerous city in America, according to Time magazine, and one of the most corrupt, according to everybody else. If you worked in the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, you were a detective. And being a detective was a lifestyle, loaded guns and good suits and cop bars that never closed. Tim imagined himself finally chasing bad guys, the way he imagined it as a little kid, the way his dad had done as a Livingston cop. At first, Tim was always at work, or at least never at home, and partying around the clock. The adrenaline was highly addictive. Detectives were like rock stars with guns. The badge gave you license, and some of the guys abused it.
That was The Good Nurse by Charles Graber. Set in Boston at the end of World War I, Dennis Lehane's The Given Day captures the political and social unrest of a nation caught at the crossroads between past and future. The book tells the story of two families, one black, one white, swept up in the maelstrom of revolutionaries and anarchists, immigrants and ward bosses, Brahmins and ordinary citizens, all engaged in a battle for survival and power. Beat cop Danny Coughlin, the son of one of the city's most beloved and powerful police captains, joins a burgeoning union movement and the hunt for violent radicals. Luther Lawrence, on the run after a deadly confrontation with a crime boss in Tulsa, works for the Coughlin family and tries desperately to find his way home to his pregnant wife. The novel captures some of the most influential figures of the era: Babe Ruth, Eugene O'Neill, Jack Reed, NAACP founder W.E.B. Du Bois, cunning Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge, and an ambitious young Department of Justice lawyer named John Hoover. Coursing through some of the pivotal events of the time, The Given Day explores the crippling violence and the exuberance of a country at war with and in the thrall of itself. Michael Boatman narrates.
He asked Frazee what it cost, a buggy like this. And Frazee idly fondled the gray upholstery as his driver pulled onto Atlantic Avenue. "More than you, Mr. Ruth," he said, and handed Ruth the flask. The inscription, etched into the pewter, read, "Ruth, G.H., Chester, Pennsylvania, 7118 to 7718. He fingered it now and took another swig, and the greasy odor of cow's blood mixed with the metallic smell of factory towns and warm train tracks. "I am Babe Ruth," he wanted to shout off the train. "And when I'm not drunk and alone at the back of a caboose, I am someone to be reckoned with. A cog in the wheel. Yes, and you bet I know it. But a diamond-crusted cog. The cog of cogs. Someday..." Ruth raised his flask and toasted Harry Frazee and all the Harry Frazees of the world with a string of lewd epithets and a bright smile. Then he took a swig, and it went to his eyelids and tugged them downward. "I'm going to sleep, you old whore," Ruth whispered to the night, to the skyline, to the smell of butchered meat, to the dark Midwestern fields that lay ahead, to every ashen mill town between here and Governor's Square, to the smoky, starless sky. He stumbled into the stateroom he shared with Jones, Scott, and McInnes, and when he woke at 6 in the morning, still fully clothed, he was in Ohio. He ate breakfast in the dining car and drank 2 pots of coffee and watched the smoke pour from the stacks in the foundries and steel mills that squatted in the Black Hills. His head ached, and he added a couple of drops from his flask to his coffee cup, and his head didn't ache anymore. He played canasta for a while with Everett Scott, and then the train made a long stop in Summerford, another mill town. And they stretched their legs in a field just beyond the station. And that's when he first heard of a strike. It was Harry Hooper, the Sox team captain and right fielder, and second baseman Dave Sheen talking to the Cubs left fielder Leslie Mann and catcher Bill Kilifer. McInnes said the 4 of them had been thick as thieves the whole trip. "About what?" Ruth said, not really sure he cared. "Don't know," Stuffy said. "Muffing flies for a price, you think? Tanking?" Hooper crossed the field to them. "We're gonna strike, boys." Stuffy McInnes said, "You're drunk." Hooper shook his head. "Who?" "The commission. Who do you think? Heidler, Herman, Johnson. Them." Stuffy McInnes sprinkled tobacco into a slip of rolling paper and gave the paper a delicate lick as he twisted the ends. "How so?" Stuffy lit his cigarette, and Ruth took a sip from his flask and looked across the field at a small fringe of trees under the blue sky. "They changed the gate distribution of the series, the percentage of receipts. They did it last winter, but they didn't tell us till now." "Wait," McInnes said. "We get 60% of the first 4 gates." Harry Hooper shook his head, and Ruth could feel his attention begin to wander. He noticed telegraph lines stretched at the edge of the field, and he wondered if you could hear them hum if you got close enough. Gate receipts, distribution. Ruth wanted another plate of eggs, some more bacon. Harry said, "We used to get 60%. Now we get 55. Attendance is down, the war, you know. And it's our patriotic duty to take 5% less." McInnes shrugged. "Then it's our... Then we forfeit 40% of that to Cleveland, Washington, and Chicago." "For what?" Stuffy said. Then another 10% to war charities. You seeing this now?" Stuffy scowled. He looked ready to kick someone. Someone small he could really get his leg into. Babe threw his hat in the air and caught it behind his back. He picked up a rock and threw it at the sky. He threw his hat again. "It'll all work out," he said. Hooper looked at him. "What?" "Whatever it is," Babe said. "We'll make it back."
That was a sampling of The Given Day by Dennis Lehane. Readers, murderers, damsels in distress, mysteries wrapped inside enigmas, thrillers are, as always, a favorite genre. It's no mystery that the next time you're looking for ideas for the next book to read, check my website, bookreportradio.com. And may I say, thank you so much for joining me today. See you back here next week on The Book Report.